Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, I have a book here called The Act of Living, what the great psychologists can teach us about surviving discontent in an age of anxiety. And it's written by Frank Tallis, who's a psychologist. He believes that the big names in psychotherapy, people like Sigmund Freud, Artie Lang, Carl Jung, etc., that they can teach us much about how to navigate our way through the complexities of modern life. And Frank is with us now, and you're very welcome to the programme. Frank, we own more than we used to. We've got better access to information and lots of other things. Yet it would seem we've got more anxious people, more depressed people, more unfulfilled people, or who seem to be so anyway. Why is life getting harder as our material circumstances get easier?
Well, I mean, that is the big question, and I think there are answers. You can answer it at a very fundamental level and say that perhaps we are generally dissatisfied for evolutionary reasons, because the brain hasn't really changed very much in about 10,000 years. And the brain has, and our nervous system evolved to cope with a particular environment, and in the sort of postmodern world, after the Industrial Revolution, the brain has had to deal with an accelerating rate of change. And if you like, the brain is sort of like left behind. I mean, this isn't a new idea. I mean, an American psychiatrist called George Beard in 1869 described a condition called neurasthenia. And he really thought this was because, of modern living, that people couldn't cope with modern life. And there are various reiterations of that theory. But you can also think of it in terms of really accelerated changes that have happened recently, such as technology. So there are studies of millions of young people in America that show a really quite profound drop in well-being after about sort of 2012. And the authors, I think, quite plausibly suggest that may be because of the widespread availability of smartphones, tablets, and that, perhaps a lot of young people are using the internet in a way that isn't particularly helpful for their mental health.
Okay, by the way, like, the full title of the book is not just called The Act of Living, it's called The Act of Living, What the Great Psychologists Can Teach Us About Surviving Discontent in an Age of Anxiety. This is a history of psychoanalysis.
Sure, it's a history,
yeah,
but it's also a history of ideas. And I hope that readers will find the book useful, because it goes over lots of ideas that the great psychotherapists talked about, and so I hope it will have an application. But I have tried to avoid oversimplifying ideas. So, of course, a lot of people go to pop psychology or celebrity gurus for information about coping with the human condition now. And, I've got nothing against that per se, but, I think that if people want to, find more enduring, thoughtful, reflective answers, then, there are some very, very, profound thinkers who we can consult from this tradition. So I hope that people will be able to see it as a history of ideas, and ideas that they can readily apply to their life.
But when you say profound thinkers, I mean, for instance, we're probably talking Freud, Jung and all the rest. Like, self-help books are all over the place. Everybody's shelves, every bookshop has special sections for self-help, celebrity sort of people, gurus, role models, etc. I mean, what yours is a very readable account of psychological writing. I mean, you don't, as you say, oversimplify the insights. Have you ever found yourself wandering into self-help territory and you have something over your kind of computer saying, ha, 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 watch yourself there, Frank?
Well, as I say, I don't have any objection to people, trying to help themselves.
Sure.
But I do have, worries and concerns when inspirational speakers and pop psychologists and celebrity gurus oversimplify ideas that are probably best approached within the tradition and within their pure form. And so, hopefully I've sort of summarized and made some of those ideas accessible in the book. And I think the problem with that sort of self-help, sort of inspirational thing is that I mean, I've noticed on the internet that lots of young people perhaps go there first and see it as something that is perhaps in competition with, you know, this other tradition, or seeking perhaps sort of proper help, or learning more about where some of these ideas come from in their in their pure and reflective form. So, so self-help, you know, and inspiration is fine, but if it obscures, you know, this body of work, then I think that is problematic, because it can be extremely useful.
Of course. Well, in terms of just the history itself, I mean, the colourful founders, let's say, of the psychoanalytic schools, I mean, you know, they often tested their theories beyond limits that you would think would be kind of acceptable. And I'll go into the word crazy, carry on. I mean, the question is, you know, did they follow their patients into madness? So, you know, did they, and how far did they go, and who went that far? Do you ever feel like going that far yourself?
Well, no, I've never been tempted myself, largely because of their example. So, I mean, of course, the vast majority of great thinkers in psychotherapy, you know, didn't go crazy, you know, experiment with their own consciousness to the extent that, you know, they lost the plot. But of course, some did. So, you know, people like Wilhelm Reich, he started off as, you know, pretty traditional Freudian, but he ended up believing that there was a life force coursing through the universe that he could collect in boxes that he called orgone accumulators, and that he thought that people could be, you know, cured of cancer. And eventually, you know, the authorities spotted him. They considered him dangerous. He was imprisoned, and he died in prison. Mm-hmm. And I guess people like, you know, Lang behaved quite wildly. Fritz Perls behaved quite wildly as well, and perhaps sort of attracted some very bad publicity. But, you know, I don't want to judge these people unkindly, because to some extent they were pioneers, and they did indeed follow their
patients. Hold on a second, Frank. Like, not so much judging them unkindly. Did their mad endeavours prove useful?
Well, I think that some of them did and some of them didn't. So I think to develop some of their ideas, they had to live on the edge. Mm-hmm. If you like, they had to sort of taste madness to be able to write about it in an interesting and engaging way. And also, I suppose, to inhabit the kind of world that their patients were inhabiting. So I think from that point of view, they conducted some extremely interesting experiments. But of course, ultimately, no, the answer is that they all, you know, those particular, that subset of psychotherapists, you know, they were great thinkers up to a point, and then they sort of crossed the line, and then they lost it, and then, you know, their intellectual contribution then diminishes quite considerably.
Okay, well, then hold on. Not to put you out of a job, Frank, but do you think a lot of people who consult a therapist don't need to? I mean, the practical insights of all the profession, you know, itself that we know, that should be good enough.
Well, you know, I think that I think the ideas on their own can be useful for a lot of people. I mean, indeed, what I'm suggesting in the book is that now so many people are suffering from, you know, what we describe as mental illnesses, that, you know, we don't really have the resources to deal with it. And actually, if you look at the economic situation at the moment, you know, in the developed world, I mean, you know, it's unlikely that we're going to have the resources anytime soon.
Absolutely.
To provide the help and support that so many people need. But it's these ideas, you know, if you are ill, I think, you know, coming to these ideas in an accessible and sort of simplified form can be useful. But, you know, behind every person who meets a diagnosis for, you know, a mental illness, you know, there's about 100 who would say they're feeling sad or dissatisfied or discontent, or have reached a point in life where they just say, well, you know, is this all there is?
Yeah.
And I think that these ideas are useful for them, that we shouldn't actually say, okay, you have to have a diagnosis before you encounter these ideas. And indeed, I mean, I think it would be reasonable to suggest that, you know, so useful is this body of knowledge that it should be made available in schools. So, we already, you know, approach sex education through biology. We we approach various forms of moral and ethical education through religious education. But I think that, given what we know of the stats at the moment, and particularly with respect to the young, raiding this body of ideas could be, incredibly useful and instructive.
That's funny you should say that, because you've said it earlier on in a different way as well, and this is what, we should see it in a much wider way than we normally do. Like, the clinical provenance of psychology, we know, it's important and all the rest of it. But you're saying that the legacy of psychotherapy has much wider importance. Can it offer, if you like, original perspectives on the big questions? Like, usually these are entrusted, as you mentioned earlier on, to philosophers or to faith people or whatever. Who am I? Why am I here? How should I live? But psychotherapy should be seen in this light more so than it is, and even be part of a, if you like, school curriculum.
Oh, absolutely. Because it's also quite practical.
Yeah.
And the answers that the great thinkers of psychotherapy arrive at are often answers that are so common sense that, people, say, well, is that so clever? Well, a lot of those ideas are actually clever, because before these guys came along and said these things, that people weren't actually saying anything similar. I mean, and they were great thinkers and had the experience which could convert into insights. If you take someone like Viktor Frankl, Viktor Frankl, spent, a very, very long time in concentration camps, and he observed, his fellow prisoners, who were living, in the most extreme and appalling conditions. And he noticed that, some of his fellow prisoners survived and some didn't. And he became sort of interested in why it was that some people survived and some didn't in those appalling circumstances. And he arrived at the idea that, the people who survived had found, a meaning. And it doesn't, have to be a great meaning. We talk about the meaning of life and pursuing that and, whatever that might be. And, of course, it's something cosmic and beyond us.
Yeah.
And actually what Frankl does is he takes something that works almost like at a cosmic level and he reduces it to the personal. And he sort of says, well, actually, if you look at people who do survive, in extreme situations, often, even then, they found some kind of particular purpose, some kind of meaning. And he talked about the will to meaning, and that if we can find a meaning, it doesn't have to be the meaning of life, but a meaning, a purpose, that can be extremely good for our long-term mental health and even our physical health. So, these are people who had extraordinary experiences. Many of them lived through terrible times historically, and were tested. And so the sort of conclusions they came to about the human condition and the conclusion they arrived at in terms of coping, are worth listening to, because, they really didn't know what they were talking about, because they had seen and lived the most extraordinary lives.
You make a very good case for maybe replacing faith-based teaching in our schools with the whole idea of psychotherapeutic thinking.
I mean, in terms of, it being a replacement for faith-based teaching, I mean, I fear that some of the readers of the book may come to the conclusion that I'm, in some way anti-religious, and I'm actually not.
No.
I think there's a great deal, that can be offered, within, religious traditions. But if you are of a sort of skeptical disposition, if you really like your beliefs to be based on observational evidence, if you are essentially a creature of the modern world, and have a generally scientific outlook, then I think this is where you're more likely to find your answers.
Than
religion or philosophy.
Right. I mean, I don't care if you're not advocating it. I am. I think it would be fantastic. We've had a few hundred years of the other one. Let's have a few hundred years now of psychotherapeutic thinking. I think it would do us all a lot of good. If you think about, just some of the examples, I mean, the basic tenets, if you like, of psychoanalysis today, do you accept them as, the malign effect of modern life on mental health? You accept all these, do you?
I do from an evolutionary point of view. I mean, certainly, the modern life, the modern world, yeah, seems to give us, enormous opportunities to be unhappy. I mean, to give you a particular example, if you look at, let's say, the internet and mental health issues in the young, if you think about how we evolved, and if you think about human communities that, our ancestors lived in, communities of maybe 150 people, so it was easy to be the best at something. You know, if you think of talents distributed, within that population, it would be easy to excel, to have self-esteem, to do something well. Mm. Now, young people are not in a community of 150 people or even in the town in which they live. You know, they're part of a global community, yeah, on the internet. And that offers an extraordinary scope for unfavorable comparisons. Oh. So, for example, if we live in a society where perhaps youth, beauty, looks are overvalued, and one can see how someone who is perhaps conscious of appearance might want to compare themselves with others, and that on the internet they are able to compare themselves with a peer group of millions, and there will be outstandingly beautiful people in that peer group, and not only that, those same people will have photoshopped their images so that they are kind of super beautiful. Yeah. Now, the effect of that is perhaps to make people feel inadequate if they are as often young people do, judge themselves in this rather narrow way of evaluating the self. And so the modern world does provide all kinds of opportunities for people to do things that make them unhappy.
And psychotherapeutic thinking can help us understand that much more. We're not talking about something that's very old. It's not like philosophy. It's not like religion. I mean, we're talking about the late 1800s. Did a class of thinkers emerge there, and what we're talking about emerged there?
Well, yes, it is a relatively new tradition,
yeah,
but it has developed. And I think it's quite important to stress that the tradition has gone beyond psychoanalysis. I mean, there are various schools of thought that have arisen from psychoanalysis as perhaps the example of the first recognisably modern form of psychotherapy. So from psychoanalysis you get ideas being developed in terms of existentialism and humanism. There are rational therapies beyond that, like cognitive therapy. It has developed, and all of these branches have something interesting to say, which is why I would like to stress that, these are branches. You can, yeah, see development over a century or more. And unfortunately, because, psychotherapy has developed in terms of schools, these schools are often viewed as being in competition and warring against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you look at it as a continuous sort of intellectual tradition, it's much greater than the sum of its parts, and it's a shame, as I say, it's seen as something that is fragmented, because if you see it in a more unitary way, you can follow the development.
Exactly. It's all part of the same thing at the end of the day. I just want to use one example. Francine Shapiro and REM, the Rapid Eye Movement, and it was a chance discovery. If you, couple REM with the kind of, the revisiting or superficial revisiting maybe of an episode, it can help people recover from like the practical application in the real world is what I'm looking at here.
Well, I mean, that's an extraordinary finding, and it was just a chance discovery that a psychotherapist called Francine Shapiro came across. She noticed that her own distressing memories, that if she moved her eyes like eyes move when people are dreaming,
yeah,
in terms of rapid eye movement, then distressing thoughts became less distressing. And she developed a sort of therapy around it, rapid eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's become a very successful therapy. And it seems to replicate, to some extent, what sleep researchers have discovered about sleep and dreaming, because there is a belief that perhaps we dream to dissolve unpleasant emotions. And so naturally it's kind of attractive to connect what dream researchers have found out about dreaming and how it helps us to rid ourselves of unpleasant emotions, and the rapid eye movement as a phenomenon used within a psychotherapy.
Yeah, right.
So I mean, that would be a very, very practical sort of example. But of course, you know, a lot of psychotherapy involves talking, and yeah. You know, there are certain ways of talking even that are more productive and helpful. So I mean, someone like Fritz Perls, who developed Gestalt therapy, noted that we sometimes use language in a particular way, a particular impersonal way that distances ourselves from our own emotions. And so, you know, someone might say, "It feels bad," rather than "I feel bad."
Yeah, yeah.
And what neuroscience has told us now is that language, you know, isn't just the words, that when we say certain words, each of those words is associated with different patterns of activation in the brain. So if you alter your language, you can alter the accessibility of your emotions. So you become more accessible to yourself.
Of course, yeah.
And therefore more able to make better life decisions. And also, if you're more accessible to yourself, you can make yourself more accessible to others, which means you're better understood, you're communicating, and they can also help you more socially in terms of your kind of peer group. So, you know, something that, you know, Perls used in psychotherapy that's very, very simple, but it's actually rooted in sort of, or rather not necessarily rooted then, but we've discovered subsequently that his ideas have legitimacy and can be kind of proved with neuroscience. And, you know, they can be used very simply in everyday life. That just, you know, specific and careful scrutiny of the language we use and the effect of that language in terms of how close it gets us or how it distances ourselves from our own emotions.
Right, indeed. And just obviously, of course, without understanding what it means to be human, there are no answers to the real questions. Frank, it's been a real pleasure talking to you on the programme today. Frank Tallis, it is. Thank you so much. The Act of Living is the name of the book. The full title is The Act of Living, What the Great Psychologists Can Teach Us About Surviving Discontent in an Age of Anxiety. In other words, right now. Thank you very much indeed, Frank, for talking to us on the programme today.
Thank you for having me.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.